And welcome to episode 74, kind of Up and In, the Baseball Prospectus podcast in DeKalb, Illinois. I'm the country mouse, Kevin Goldstein. In Brooklyn, New York, he's the city mouse. He's Jason Parks. Jason, say hello to the internet.
I'm the country mouse. That's funny. That's like you're like a trucker. That's your call sign.
Break or run is country mouse. Got any bears up ahead?
Right, don't be scared of those loud noises. It might come from the cornfield.
Exactly. You still haven't said hello, though, Jason.
Howdy. How's it going?
Yeah, great. We have a very short show for you. We have a lot of stuff going on. We have some off-the-field stuff, a lot of on-the-field stuff. We're trying to get a ton of things done before we leave for Dallas on Sunday, which we'll talk about later. So you'll get a feel for what kind of shows you're going to get next week, and you're going to get a lot of shows next week. And so we're going to more than make up for it. But we got so many emails from you guys that we wanted to read some of them, because we're not going to get to them next week, because we're going to be doing the show on site, if you will. And so we wanted to read some of your emails, talk about what's happening next week, then we'll be out of here. Just a one-segment show, quick and done. Is that okay with you, Jason? Oh, and Jason has that just happened.
Yeah.
That literally just happened. So
it did just happen.
It's a late addition to the agenda. Housekeeping, of course, you want to email us. And, if you want to email us while we're in Dallas, maybe we'll get some of them. I don't know. As long as you make them kind of show specific. It's podcast@baseballprospectus.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter, I'm at Kevin_Goldstein. Jason is at Professor Parks. We have a Facebook page where we do the Facebook thing. We almost have 1,000 Facebook people, Jason.
Great.
And if you are one of the majority of people listen to us on iTunes, we do ask you to go rate and review us. It does help, believe it or not. It's time for the email, Jason.
Okay.
First email comes from someone named Jason. That is not Jason. And Jason writes, Kevin Cabral's mention of broadcasting over another broadcast took me back to my teenage years, when for a couple of years I lived in South Korea at the time, then Dodger phenom and eternal Texan legend Chan Ho Park first rose to prominence. For weeks, I suffered through well-meaning yet wall-punchingly clueless analysts fumbling through one National League game after another. This continued until one seminal lunch break in the autumn of 1997, after I had trotted home to catch a few innings of the young hurler, when I discovered the sap button on my remote and finally liberated the dulcet tone original, the voice of Vin Scully. Truly a magical moment. And Scott, I'm glad you got Vin in Korea instead of what you had. Now to a much less magical but more topical item. The current free agent frenzy regarding Pujols, Prince, Wilson, etc. brought back a question that I've harbored for a while. Why don't teams front load monster free agent contracts? It seems most contracts start from below the average, the AAV, and then eventually escalate significantly in later years. I realize that management would probably want to delay the impact of a huge salary for as long as possible. Relatedly, I also suspect that time value of money plays a role in this decision. However, at what point does the free agent's diminishing return negatively outweigh the short-term payroll flexibility and time value of the money? Wouldn't front-loading also prevent, or at least reduce, the risk of aging players decline into unwanted commodity in his mid to late 30s when the team would often seek to trade him? Thanks for your continued production of this wonderful show that has transformed my Jersey to Connecticut commute. That's got to be brutal. Into an enjoyable experience that I actually anticipate once a week. Jason, it's an excellent question. Why don't teams front load contracts? And I'm going to tell you the ugly reason. There's very few of them out there, but A-Rod's contract's front loaded. He's getting like 26 or 7 this year, and it slims down to 20 like in 2016-17. But for the most part, people don't do that. And here's the reason. Teams are many teams, especially the teams that are signing huge free agents, are focused on winning now. And so you give the guy whatever it takes. You don't worry about the lesser years, because here's how it works. People are interested in keeping their jobs in front offices. And as we've seen this offseason, it's hard to keep your job in a front office. We've had, obviously, a ton of turnaround in front offices. And that's what happens when things go wrong. So if you sign a guy, if things go right, people don't care so much about the end of that contract. And if things go wrong, you lose your job, and that's not your problem anymore. That's the ugly truth. You either win, and then that's not a problem, or you lose, and it's not your problem. But I don't know. What happened to Jason there? We don't know.
I'm here. There was a truck that went by.
We just had.
It's caught up in its it's caught up in that mood.
And we just had the cops at Juan Deli before we started recording.
Yeah, they're still there.
Is everything okay at Juan Deli?
I don't think it has anything to do with Juan. It's going on outside of Juan. They still have the lights on. They don't have there's two cars that I can see. I don't know what they're doing. They're out there.
Our next email comes from
Don't
Matt.
be scared.
I'm not scared of loud noises. Matt's from Toronto. And Matt says, Mr. Goldstein in the Park, I just finished watching Enter the Void. So I feel like I'm in a good frame of mind to converse with you two. What is
Jesus, Gaspar, man.
that?
That stuff, yeah, that's a whacked out film.
A Goldstein tweet from 2 months ago has been stuck in my head. I guess I have. That was Death Rattle the Marionette. The gist of it was that Greg Golson has the best tools you've ever seen, but that Golson still stinks at baseball.
All
I know you've
right.
discussed this topic ad nauseum, but I've not quite got it. What's the magic potion that turns a tool shed like Golson into an elite major leaguer? Should actualization be considered a sixth tool? That is to say, what makes one player better at harnessing 80 raw power than another? How is one pitcher with an 80 arm better able to translate that tool than another? Finish this sentence. Tools are useless without blank. And with Golson, is it solely an inability to turn tools into skills, or is it possible we haven't graded the tools properly? Did the scouts miss something? And if they did, shouldn't the case of Gregory Joseph Golson not make us reconsider our emphasis on the five-tool player as the pot at the end of the rainbow? Or, if, as your tweet and my eyeball suggest, the tools are so clearly elite, then is this a player a developmental failure? Is not turning a player with his tools into at least a starter on a first division team a fireable offense? If the ability to project success at the major league level is what separates the scouting world's wheat from the chaff, what is to be learned here? Nickelback still stinks, Matt. Matt, you have 8 million questions here.
Let's go back to the fill in the blank one.
Okay. Tools are useless without.
Adjustment.
Oh, that's a good answer. $200, Jason.
Thank you. I
Instead
wanted more, but I'll take the 200.
of a
I think it was more than two, but yeah. Adjustment. I think the ability to fail and adjust to that failure is really what separates a lot of these really gifted physical athletes. I mean, there are a lot of. I mean, Golson is, yeah, he's one of the most amazing, toolsiest players I've ever seen, as well. And you would think that somebody like that would eventually figure it out. But I mean, a lot of it just comes down to being able to make the necessary adjustments at the major league level. Look at Matt Wieters. He didn't just arrive at the major league level and start kicking ass. I mean, in fact, there are still some people who are wondering how much he's going to be able to offer. I mean, it's about failing and then adjusting. You can be the most talented player in the world. If you don't adjust to the level of competition, you're not going to amount to anything. What's your answer there?
I liked your answer. I think adjustment's good. And I was going to say without aptitude.
Aptitude. No, that's actually that's a $200 one as well.
Well, good. Because
Mine was three, yours is two.
okay. Because you got to remember where Golson came from. I mean, Golson's tools, as crazy as they were, still merited only the 20. I'm looking this up because I'm cheating. The 21st pick in the draft in
Not the
2004.
first.
Not the
Right.
first or the second or the eighth, but the 21st. And it's not because he fell off of money concerns. 21st was about where people thought he was going to go. And because he was so raw. And you're talking about a guy who was in a pretty small town in Texas. And was not playing against a ton of competition. It's not a situation where he's coming to you very advanced. It was a pure athlete bet. You were saying, I'm going to get this kid and see if I can teach him how to play baseball.
Right.
And so you start off in a pretty deep hole, but you just know the potential payoff is good. And this is the thing. I mean, there's Greg Golsons all over the place, and some of them turn into great players, and most of them don't. But adjustments is one thing. I hate to say developmental failures. I mean, it's if you throw Greg Golson in front of a professional instruction staff, the best professional instruction staff you've ever seen, you're still setting them up to fail because you're starting in such a hole. So I hate that. I don't. I've never been a fan of blaming developmental staffs. It's a really tough way to go, because, much like the game itself, you are bound to fail. I mean, you are the baseball's a game of failure, and so, the chances of them turning Golson into something was really small, and I think everybody knew that going in, and he never, really learned to hit. It just the hitting never really came around. There's always just too much swing and miss in them, and the hand-eye coordination just never was there. But everything else was so good.
Everything else was really, really good. And here's the thing about the developmental staff. I mean, I think they did a pretty good job getting a guy who was that raw, at least to that level, in the first place. That's kind of a win. I mean, you can teach Greg Golson the fundamentals of baseball. What you can't teach him is, the feel for the game, the instincts for hitting. I mean, hitting itself is very, it's something that it's a feel. You use instincts and feel and comfort, and you can't teach a player to feel that. You can put them in situations where they will develop that on their own, but he didn't have it.
Yeah, and no one's to go back to some of your questions. Did the scouts miss something? No. I mean, the scouting reports going in said this is what this is. This is a monster athlete who can't play baseball. I mean, that's what everyone knew that going in. This is a risky guy. The Phillies, since the dawn of time have taken these kind of guys. This is that they love Anthony Hewitts of the world, and sometimes you get something really great out of it. Sometimes you get Jimmy Rollins out of it, and so. But this one, it didn't work. I mean, there's no, you buy these guys, or the emphasis on the five-tool player is there, because of what's at the end of the rainbow if they work out. You need, if you don't take these guys, if you just avoid them because they're too risky, then you never win. You never get the payoff. And so,
Yeah, because he could have been a
right. And
superstar.
so you take them knowing, I mean, you'd rather have a system with, 20 guys who have a 2% chance of being a superstar than not having any of those, because you need one of those things to pay off, especially if you're a small market team, especially now, in order to find those kind of players who can become stars on your team, because you're not going to get free agents that are.
No, was he gifted? Oh, man. He could throw. I mean, his arm was so strong. His batting practice power was really impressive too.
Yeah,
His
he's above
speed,
average.
I mean, just everything about this guy was awesome, except the awesome part during the game. That rarely showed up. But see, still every once in a while, even when he made it up to the major league level, he would make a throw that you go, whoa, whoa, not many people can do that.
Our next email comes from Aaron. Aaron's in San Francisco, and Aaron says, "Greetings, Country Mouse and City Mouse.
Oh,
Is
man.
it just me, or is the idea that failed position player prospects could become pitchers becoming more and more commonplace? As a Twins fan, I remember when Joe Nathan established himself as a dominant closer, most Twins fans thought it was remarkable that he began his career as a shortstop. Like this was a feat comparable to Bo Jackson or Deion Sanders playing two sports. Now, though, with the success story of Jason Mott and the potential success story of Matt Bush, it doesn't seem so far-fetched. It seems like in every prospect roundup on the podcast, one of you will drop a casual aside along the lines of, and if it doesn't work with the bat, that arm would definitely play on the mound. I ask because of Aaron Hicks. With every negative review coming in on Hicks's bat, the legend of his arm looms larger and larger. I know it's not time to give up yet, but how does giving up work? For a top prospect like Hicks, when his hopes totally gone? At what point would a team ask a player to try a move to the mound? Does this usually require a release in a new organization? Would there be a transition period where the player might play both ways? Given the incredible value of an elite starting pitcher or the incredible perceived value of an elite closer, I'm surprised more teams aren't pushing this transition. I'm not trying to minimize the incredibly difficulty and the risk inherent in such a move, but we can dream, right? Sure, you can dream, Aaron. But let's talk about this. I think we've had some success, and but it's really nothing new. I mean, we can go back to Brian Harvey. We can go back to the. I'm sure Stephen Goldman could name guys from the 30s and 40s and 50s who went from position
No doubt.
pitchers. And so it's not new, but obviously we've had some guys who have been high profile. It's important to note that almost all of them turned to relievers, just because you're basically trying to turn them into power arms. You're not going to teach them. You just don't have enough time for them to develop. The craft, if you will. Now, Aaron Hicks was a hell of a pitcher in high school. Aaron Hicks was obviously an incredibly athletic pitcher who could touch 97. He was scary. There were teams that preferred him as a pitcher. He told teams he didn't want to sign as a pitcher. If he said he would have been a pitcher, he still would have been a first-round pick as a pitcher. He was that good. But now you get into the biggest question in this email, and the toughest one to answer, is how does giving up work? For the most part, when you talk about Jason Mott, you're talking about a guy who was a fringy pick to begin with as a catcher. Had very little chances it was, and so he was more than willing to do it. They said, look, it's obvious you can't hit when you go to the mound. Yeah, of course it will, because if I don't, I'm out of baseball. Aaron Hicks still has crazy tools, and it's going to be tough to it would be very tough to convince Aaron Hicks to do it. I don't think you should do it yet, which is important. But it's probably going to have to come, or the idea is probably going to have to come from Hicks. It's a lot easier and a lot better, and creates a lot more positive environment if the player chooses to do something than if you simply tell him this is what you're going to do. And this, forget about a really big move, like from position player to pitcher, but just think about a move from, shortstop to off shortstop. I remember just a great lesson I learned from someone, and really just a couple of years ago that it really struck home with me. It concerned Mike Moustakas, who was still playing shortstop at the time for Kane County. Not for King County, for Burlington in the Midwest League, and it didn't take a genius to watch him play shortstop and go, there's no way he can play shortstop. But then I was talking to somebody, in the game about him. I said, there's no way he can play shortstop. I don't know why they just move him. And he said, let him. He's because they're going to let him figure that out. It's much better to say, instead of just pulling him aside and go, hey, you're going to go to third base. It's easier for him to realize himself that he's not going to be able to play shortstop at this level, and he did. And so the move to third base was a lot more easy because it was accepted in his head. And so I don't think anyone's ready to give up on Hicks. He's still very young. He's 22 years old. The tools are still kind of crazy. I think you're probably at least 2 years away from even wanting to think about it, really.
Right. I mean, I think you nailed it. I think that, the player has to be willing. They have to acquiesce to that. They have to be willing to put in all the necessary work to become a pitcher, which is a completely different, approach than they had been taking the previous years, and like Hicks, these players that come up, I mean, when you have really, really strong arms, they've probably been, position players since they were in Little League, but because they had strong arms, they also pitched, and that's probably true of high school. Sometimes that's even true in college.
Yeah.
Where you put them on the mound because they can throw 90 without a lot of effort. But to transition into the relief role, I mean, you have to go through a completely different approach, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of want. And, some guys, they don't want to pitch. They're not pitchers. They're position players. That's a different animal.
Yeah, you know, another good example that I just thought of was Casey Kelly. The Red Sox drafted Casey Kelly in the first round, and they wanted him to pitch, and he didn't want to pitch. He wanted to be shortstop. That's how he identified himself. And the Red Sox almost kind of made a deal with him and said, first year you're going to play shortstop for half a year, then you're going to pitch. Or it was actually vice versa. And he pitched great, and then he played shortstop and was awful. And, that's a lot easier than to talk to him about making a decision. Okay, well, that was your first year. Boy, as a pitcher, you were an all-star, and as a hitter, you struggled to get above the Mendoza line. Pitching's probably better for your future. Don't you agree that pitching's better for your future? Yes, now I see why you're saying that. I'm going to be a pitcher now. Yeah, that's a lot more than just saying, screw you, you're pitching, even though you want to be a shortstop.
Right. I mean, look at a guy like Matt West, a guy in the, it was a second-round pick for the Rangers, failed position prospect.
Yeah.
This is a guy who I have in the top 10 in the Rangers system. I think that he is kind of a special arm. I mean, you don't usually see guys who move to the mound who not only have this sort of stuff, like 270 grade pitches, but who have command, or at least feel for command and projection.
You don't see like 22-year-olds who, after throwing 27 innings, the first 27 innings of their career in short season ball, get protected on the 40 minutes. They don't get to the rule five.
Right. And here's the thing about Matt West. Matt West was always kind of a pitcher, if that makes sense. He always, he pitched in school. He would throw bullpens on the side. This is something, pitching was always something that was kind of a part of him. It wasn't like a complete foreign entity. It wasn't a completely different animal for him to go to the mound. When the subject came up of him moving to the mound, he took to it very quickly and willingly, and he felt comfortable on the mound. This is not a guy who they said, here, you've never pitched, you have a strong arm, let's see what happens. It was a little bit different, and I think those have a better, success rate than guys who just hand a ball and say, "You have a strong arm. You're a failed prospect. You're a failure in this regard. Don't be a failure in this one."
Yeah, and he was a second round pick out of a Texas high school in 2007. And spent two after some short season ball, spent 2 years at low A hitting nothing. You're hitting 220, 230 with a ton of strikeouts, and obviously it wasn't going to work. Next year he's probably going to start the year.
Double.
Floor is Myrtle Beach, and he'll at least get to double A, and I mean really could be in the big leagues by September. I mean
He
it's
really
he
could.
really could. But that's a second round pick who did it, and it's tough. But to go back to another one of your questions, Aaron, San Francisco, would there be a transition period where the player might play both ways? No. You have to do one or the
They're two
other.
different. I mean, pitchers work out differently than
Right.
position players do. It's a different schedule. As I said, that's why a lot of position players look at pitchers as just completely different entities. They don't work out together. They don't, a
No.
lot of them don't click together. I mean, they're different.
Yes. Pitchers, if you look, go to a clubhouse, pitchers tend to hang out with pitchers.
It's because they spend all their time together. They do their bullpens, their stretches, their runs. Position players do it with other position players. It's not, I mean, when you switch over, you basically turn your back on what you were and you have to become something completely different. That's why, I mean, and a lot of the conversions, you don't hear about them. I mean, I'm sure every organization's trying it, and has always tried it, is that a lot of pitchers, after, their failed position prospects, they get hurt because they're not used to the arm action is different. They're pitching off a mound. They get hurt and you never hear from them again.
And so many of them don't look like pitchers. If you watch a couple converted catchers in the big leagues, Jason Mott, of course, with the Cardinals, who
What a beard,
was their closer,
Jesus.
and Kenley Jansen with the Dodgers, when you watch them pitch, they both just watch them pitch a few times and kind of take your eye off the batter's box, if you will, when you watch them. Just watch the pitcher, and you'll say to yourself, "Man, they look like the catcher's throwing the ball," because
They
that's
look like throwers,
they look
yeah.
like catchers, which is what they were.
Right.
That's almost their mechanics, and so again, usually your upside for the most part is usually a reliever. You're going to start with a guy who throws hard and try to teach him a slider more often than not, just because a slider is easier to teach than if he's never thrown a curve, and forget about a changeup. It's not going to happen.
Not enough time to make that feel happen,
Right, and so
no.
you're just going to end up asking some guy to throw hard, and so but that was a good question there.
Great question.
Our next email comes from Cam Wolf, and Cam Wolf says, "Well, listening back to episode 9.0, these people, I love them. A comment struck me where I said, I like scouts. Who doesn't like scouts? Of course, I agree with that. Would it be possible to have a scout on? Perhaps preserve their anonymity, not give them a name, but it'd be interesting to hear about the life of a scout, some of the stories they could tell, perhaps their opinions on a few players and other aspects that wouldn't breach any secrets of their team. Do you think it might be possible, if not an active scout, maybe a retired scout, yours, Camel?" No, I've tried. I've tried to work it out in my head. I even talked to some scouts about it, and we are very lucky to find the ones that will talk to us. But no one's going to talk to us in a public forum. It's just not going
It's not
to
good for
happen.
them.
It's not going to happen. I would love to do it. I agree with you. It would be a fascinating look at the life. They would tell amazing stories like they always do. It's just not going to happen. Period. As far as a retired scout or an ex-scout, I like the idea. I have some names in mind. I'm going to look into it. But a current scout, I've thought about it a million times. There's just no way we can make it work.
Well, I mean, I haven't gone right out and asked, but I mean, I've kicked the tires on that a little bit with a couple of scouts, and when it finally came to, would you, when I
No.
danced around it
Yeah.
enough, it was like, oh man, I love the show, but no,
Yeah.
fuck you guys,
Exactly.
I like my job.
Our next email comes from Scott. Scott's in Pelham, New York. And Scott wants to talk a little bit over the fact that our good friend Josh Lukey got traded to the Rays. And of course, I made sure I took care of Twitter and let everybody know what a jerk he is. And Scott says, "One of the reasons the podcast is so terrific is your willingness to occasionally move the conversation away from baseball into realms like physics, Middle Eastern affairs, and of course, hawk traps. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind making a tangent into your philosophy of criminal justice. Kevin recently tweeted that in your perfect world, Josh Lukey would never make the majors and that you would never hire a guy like him at Baseball Prospectus. He has tweeted that Michael Vick should never again be permitted to play football, and he hopes Vick suffers a career-ending injury. My email is not a defense of dog torturers nor rapists, but to extrapolate from Kevin's Twitter posts, he would not allow anyone who's committed certain crimes to play professional sports or work for an enterprise he controls. This position seems at odds with your left-of-center leanings, as you spoke of them in episode 73 in response to the Air Force officer's email, so I guess it's time for you to rant. Are some crimes so morally repugnant that those who commit them should be excommunicated, or can a criminal pay his debt to society and be allowed back in? Scott. Can of worms, Scott. Big can of worms, and it's my can. I have to deal with it. Yeah, I you know, excommunicate's a bit strong, sure. I'm saying that there are certain things. There are certain things in this world where if you do them, you should not be allowed to play professional sports. I think playing professional sports is a privilege, not a right. And more importantly, I just never been a fan of the concept of the athlete as a role model. Never have been. Don't think they should be them. Don't think anyone should look up to them as role models. But at the same time, I do know that some do, and I would never, ever want my team to employ a person who did what Josh Lucchi did. Ever. Ever. If Josh Lucchi wants to go work at Sears, if Josh Lucchi wants to hit the private sector and become a data entry specialist, I have no problem with that. But as a public figure, no, I think he should be shut down. And here's the thing. I don't think there should be some sort of law about it. I'm not in for blackballing the guy. I just wish for a world where every team said no to him on their own accord. And I wish for the same when it comes to Michael Vick and what Michael Vick did. Michael Vick wants to, open a stereo store. Great. Michael Vick wants to, get into graphic design. Fantastic.
But, I'd like to see that, actually.
But Michael Vick, as a public figure, should be allowed to play football? No, he shouldn't. I do think there are certain crimes where, no, you should not be allowed to play sports anymore. But you should be allowed to do certain things. As for my left-of-center leanings, I guess those are what they are, but there's plenty of people on the left who hate me. I believe conceptually in the death penalty. I hate the way it's used in the United States. I think it's pretty much racist the way it's used in the United States, but the concept of society being able to decide that certain people should die is I'm totally cool with. I'm not a pacifist. There's plenty of people on the left who hate me. I'd simply believe what I believe.
Right. I mean, and back to the question, I mean, I'm not a moralist or anything, but, like redemption tales, I mean, they require, an act that needs to be redeemed. And it's all in your connection to that act. I make a lot of off-color jokes about a lot of off-color things, and I'm sure that they offend some people in my universe because those people have been affected by those things and they take them very strongly, and I appreciate that. And I don't really have a problem with Vic playing in the NFL because I like watching him play. I don't like the Eagles, so I hope they don't do well, and I don't want him to do well because of that. But if I were, and this may sound ridiculous, but if I were the owner of a rescued pit bull, a dog that I acquired, from the jaws of a bad situation and raised it as my own and saw all the joy that that animal gave me, and then I saw somebody like Michael Vick, I would probably have a stronger reaction towards him.
Sure.
And so it's about the connection, I don't like him because he's an eagle. That's where it ends for me. As far as Lukey, though, I don't like the guy at all. I don't like him as a person. I don't like what he did. Whether he should be in baseball or not, I don't know. I mean, I think that that's up to the organization. If I ran an organization, would I bring him in? No.
Yeah, and that's what I was.
Will I root for him? No.
I was trying to say I actually do think it's totally up for the organization. And again, I don't think Bud Selig should ban him. I don't think there should be some sort of rule. I wish we lived in a world where every team said, I don't want any part of that.
Right. I mean, but what if there's a guy and he really likes warm beer, he doesn't like a chill on his beer. I can't get over it. I don't want him on my team. I don't care if he comes, comes out and has a press conference and says, I was wrong. Warm beer is terrible. I like beer that holds a chill. Not Negra Modelo. I like beer that holds a chill. I'm still, it's too late. Too late for me.
It's good to equate that. That's good.
They're very similar, in my opinion. That's how strongly I feel about the beer. See, there I am making light of it again.
Yeah, see, it's all you can do when you think about what he did. It's
so bad that if you really spend time thinking about it,
and look into it if you want. I mean, do a Google search and go past the first couple. Go past the first couple stories. Read those first couple stories, but do a Google search. Do a Google search for his name with a DNA test, and you can see what things he tested positive for, and you can learn about terms like anal swabs. And it's what he did was repugnant and disgusting, and I hope the Rays go 0-162 now.
I mean, look, we all make mistakes, and
that's not a mistake.
It's all about the severity of the mistake, right. And it's a pretty severe mistake, and I don't even know if it's a mistake. It's just severe behavior,
right.
And it affected. You know, it affected someone's life for the rest of their life, and that's hard to excuse. It really is hard to get over that.
Right. I want nothing to do with him, and if you're a Rays fan, neither should you, and maybe you should let them know that.
I'm actually surprised they got that kind of return.
In Giant, a decent catcher?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm actually surprised. I mean, good for Seattle there, but, I mean, Tampa, why do you do this? Why do you make this move?
You can root for the Mariners again. Yippee. I like that. I can say go Mariners now.
Well, the Mariners were the ones who brought him in the first place and denied.
Yeah, that was something.
I mean, that's another. It made for good television, at least, but it's a bad subject.
Our next email comes from Brian. Brian's also in San Francisco.
And great city.
And Brian has a question for us that we cannot answer, which is, how can I get a job doing what you're doing?
What are we doing?
I don't know. Or just working in the world of player and statistical analysis. I'm a writer. I'm a statistics and economics student. And I've even started a club on my campus, BATS, for Baseball Analysis and Theory Society. I have no idea what to do outside of that, where to apply, or who to talk to. Thanks. Brian. Brian.
That's a lively club.
It sounds like a fun time. But here's the thing.
That seems like a fun time.
I have no idea how you can get a job doing what I'm doing, because everybody I know who does what I do has a different path. I think the most important thing you can do is to start writing and getting your shit out there. And if it's good enough, someone will notice.
Absolutely.
And if somebody notices, maybe you'll end up going from your blog to somewhere else that more people look at. And if things go well there, maybe you'll go to somewhere else that even more people look at, and eventually you'll be bigger than me and Chase.
Yeah, and
or you know what? Maybe what and maybe your maybe your stuff will stink and it won't. I don't know. But there's all I can really tell you is to start doing stuff and getting it out there. There's no path. There's no roadmap. There's nothing. You guys know this. I mean, Jason, studied art in college, was doing some other stuff, and started blogging. Jason and I became friends and started a podcast, and I got him to write for us. I was working in internet technology marketing and evangelism, and I ended up doing this.
right.
Craig Calcaterra was a lawyer, and he ended up doing this.
Right.
Jay Jaffe went to Brown. I forget what he studied, but it's nothing to do with this. And he ended up doing this. There's no answer for you. There's no path. There's no book. There's no directions. There's no manual. Just start doing something and get your name out there, and hopefully things will work out.
Yeah, just create your own path. I mean,
yeah, everyone
it can lead to the same goal.
Yeah, everyone I know has. There's, I, go. I, I'm not. I'm not trying to say don't, but I have no advice for you other than that. I don't know. I have no idea how I could give you advice other than that. That's all I got for you. Our next email comes from John, and John says, "Howdy, Professor and Kev. You're off to a bad start, John. Don't call me Kev."
You're up to a bad start.
I hate when people call me Kev. If you're listening, don't. It's not a Sarge or a Country Mouse thing, which I'm fine with. Don't, Kev, just. Ugh. I have a question and a suggestion or something like that. There are two different topics I have for you to discuss. First off, can you please stop using the word sexy to describe prospects or anything in sports? I hear this all the time and I find it annoying. I find it odd that male analysts use this description. If calling sweaty, athletic men sexy is your thing, then hey, great. Not that there's anything wrong with it. If Sam, Ryan, Hazelmayer, Aaron Andrews were to use it, I'd find that fine and dandy, but I've never heard a female analyst use them. I don't think I'm homophobic. I think you might be, John.
You don't think so? I think something's up.
As I've made my living doing theater for 5 years and did acting in alternative theater in Wisconsin that did lots of original works about sexual politics, including something called Count Fagula and the first ever play about male impotence, which was
first ever
for the Christmas Carol, complete with the ghosts of fucking past, present, and future. Mahalo and namaste, bitches. John. John, if you have a problem with Jason and I describing a guy as sexy, if that somehow irps you, I think there might be some homophobic tendencies within you.
Yeah, John. Here it comes, John. first of all, calling someone sexy, or so, like a skill set, something inanimate, is not necessarily sexual. You know, over the Thanksgiving holiday, I made a badass pork chili, and it was sexy. You know, I did not stick my dick in the chili and get sexual with it. Okay? I did. Bad example. But normally, it's not a sexual thing. It was just a sexy chili.
Right.
You know, like, somebody having a sexy swing, and I'm not going to stop that. Second of all, anytime that you have to tell someone that you're not homophobic during a homophobic rant, you're probably homophobic.
There's some sort of problem here.
You know, and I want to know how you felt when you wrote sweaty and athletic. You know, I mean, I really want to know. And also, here's another point. If you heard a female, you know, like Erin Andrews, I guess that if she called a player sexy, you would really be okay with that?
Yeah, I don't get why it's okay for Hazel May to call someone sexy. Now, I've not ever heard her, but if she was, that would be okay. But if I say, man, Greg Golson had some sexy tools, that bothers you for some reason.
He was a sexy man.
Weird.
Hey, John, Greg Golson was a sexy man in general. How about them apples? You know, I don't understand how somebody who, you know, not only says they're, you know, not homophobic or had some experience in theater, you know, would dive into what should be an outdated, you know, heteronormative paradigm. I mean, it's ridiculous to me that you took the time to write into the podcast to question or to comment on us calling, describing a player as sexy because it bothers you. What the fuck is wrong with you? There's nothing wrong with us. Greg Golson has
a
sexy
arm. With us, it's just not that.
He had a sexy arm, a sexy smile. Have you ever seen him smile? It was sexy, John. It was sweaty and athletic and sexy. And the next time I describe a player, this is what's going to happen, John. I'm going to go like this. Jorge Alfaro, and this goes out to John, when he crouches behind the plate with his ultra-sexy thighs and ripped lean muscle mass, John, this goes out to you. With his sweaty athleticism and his bulbous muscular frame.
Let's play a quick game, Jason. I'm gonna name a prospect. I want you to tell me what you think about his tools, okay?
Okay.
Mike Trout.
Sexy.
Bryce Harper.
Sexy.
Eric Hosmer.
Ooh, shit. All the way sexy. All the way around.
Dominic Brown, really on just a tools level.
Sexy.
Absolutely. Jose Iglesias is fielding.
Sexual. I mean, it's so sexy, it's sexual.
Rodis Vizcaíno's fastball.
Oh, sweaty and athletic.
Let's see here. Billy Hamilton's speed from first to third.
Oh my God, sexual, sexy. Very smooth and silky with lean muscle and just pure sweaty athleticism.
It's fluid and sexy. There's sexy.
It's so sexy.
Sexy and fluid there, John.
God. What's wrong with our world? I mean, really? This is really? You wrote in with this, man?
Here's the question, John. Obviously, you can't respond to us, but if I talk about someone and I'd say, you know, I saw Taiwan Walker and then, boy, that's
sexy.
That's sexy stuff. Do you really think, like, in my drive on the way home from Peoria to here, like, I masturbated while thinking about it?
Bad example again.
I mean, it's a term, John. I think it does kind of make you homophobic. I got to be honest with you.
Or repressed.
The fact that you find it annoying, to use your words, and odd that male analysts use this description, It's a perfectly fine adjective. It expresses what I want to say in a way that I think is quite accurate.
Yeah. I mean, come on, man.
So do you...
It's okay to acknowledge the sexiness of the same sex. It's okay, man. It's okay.
And we can even talk about actual sexiness. I
Yes.
can totally understand why people,
Greg Golson's smile is actually sexy.
Jim Morrison, I can see why people thought he was sexy. Jim Morrison was sexy.
It was sexy,
Yeah, I'm
John.
fine with that. I don't want to have sex with him, but yes, he was sexy. See how that works? Doesn't bother me.
Right. I mean, I might watch him have sex. I might be in the same room, but I'm not going to have sex with him. I mean, if you had a tape, I'd probably view it. But that's it.
Okay, moving on from sexiness. Our next
Now I'm going to use it more, John. John, you know what you did.
email comes from Brad. We're gonna move from sexiness to a little music, John or Jason. You're not John, you're Jason. I'm glad you're Jason and not John. And Brad writes, I was recently reading a back and forth on Twitter with Kevin and some of his followers about you too. Because of course, about once a week, I like to insult a band because I'm endlessly fascinated and entertained by the fact that it really pisses people off for some reason. I couldn't agree more about U2 and actually find the Nickelback comparisons quite accurate. I did compare U2 to Nickelback, by the way.
I don't know how accurate it is. I mean,
Just in
one's
the just in the...
complete shit and one has at least been able to
My
maintain.
comp was in the in, it was in the earnestness of it all.
I understand, yes.
The conversation got me wondering, though, do either of you guys have guilty pleasures? We've heard a lot about cool bands, cool artsy movies, etc. Rarely do we hear about something mainstream popular that you guys enjoy. I was actually shocked to hear Kevin discussing a Frosty in episode 72, as I would have guessed that you would never step foot inside a Wendy's. So any guilty pleasure? Well, I mean, just real quick on.
Do you only like indie Frosties?
Right, I only have indie Frosties. Real quick, I'm a big proponent of crap food. I like cooking fine, but I think crap food is something that should be at times a perfect.
I think crap anything can be
Right, White
appreciated.
Castle is wonderful.
I mean, sometimes it's camp and sometimes crap is just good.
Yeah. So what are you, do you have any guilty pleasures?
Yeah,
Musically,
a
I mean,
ton of
it's,
course.
I don't know, is I like
I watched a I'm an open Degrassi fan.
I watch listen, I watch I like Amazing Race. How's that?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty crappy, but I mean, it's whatever floats your boat. I mean, not everything has to be intellectually stimulating or have merit. I
It's
mean,
okay.
sometimes I like to watch, fake Italians bang each other and get drunk on Jersey Shore. I mean, that's why not?
Storage Wars, like Storage Wars.
I've never seen that, but I know some people who that's their guilty
I
pleasure.
like Storage Wars. See, we can do this, Brad. It's okay. We're not the douchebag hipsters.
No, I mean, and look, I get it, you look at anybody's iTunes.
Kanye West.
Well, I mean, go worse than that, Vanilla Ice. I mean, anything crappy
Well, I
that we
don't
were
like it,
based
but
on.
Biz Markie I like. Biz Markie, I
Yeah,
that's a
but I
good song.
mean, there's a lot of crap that I grew up going to junior high dances and felt shame about. I enjoy now for several reasons, It's cool to like crap sometimes. I mean, sometimes it brings back memories of what a shitty time that was, or what a good time that was, or who your friends were then, or how you thought then. I mean, and sometimes it's okay, watching things that are really stimulating requires your participation. It requires effort on your part. Sometimes I like to listen to something or watch something that requires very little effort on my part, and I'll just let it happen. I actually like I like his follow-up question there. Or is that not from him?
No,
No, that's
that's our
somebody
next
else.
question. Our next question comes from Matt.
That's a great question. That was actually a good question too, Brad.
Matt sends us an email pretty much every week, and this one had 10 questions in it.
And you
And
picked
so I
one,
just
number
chose one. This is
seven.
number 7 from Matt. And
Oh,
sticking to the
one. Okay.
music terms, and he says, if you could become the lead singer or guitarist or drummer or whatever of any band at any time and experience their fame, who would it be?
That is one of the best questions ever.
I love this question. I thought about it. I put a lot of thought into this. So who's your answer, Jason?
Okay, I mean it might surprise you actually. It really might surprise you because this is not like a band that or a band that I listen to on a regular basis, but it has a lot to do with like the
Yeah,
time.
sure. That my answer is also based very much in the time and place. So go ahead.
I would like to be like Mitch Mitchell, the drummer for Jimi Hendrix, and be able to go on that ride where in like, you know, 66, 67, you have this American alien, you know, playing guitar in London, you know, in a time where that scene is exploding and everything's new and everything's vibrant, playing in a small club in front of like, you know, John Lennon or Eric Clapton, who's about to discover you and, you know, put you on the world's map. And you're playing in this club and you're sitting behind the kit and you're facing, you know, this weird alien doing things with an instrument that no one's ever heard before. And then you're about to go on that ride. I think that that would just be the most incredible experience to participate in. I mean, I as a Beatle fan, I would go Beatlemania, but I'd probably hang myself.
Right, right.
Because I couldn't handle that. But to be able to experience, you know, almost from afar, almost, you know, in the curtains, you know, almost somewhere where no one knows who you are, and get to watch this, you know, thing explode onto the music scene and change music forever. I think that that would just be absolutely fascinating.
Okay. I'm also going to go to the 1960s, believe it or not. And this is not a band that really experienced any fame at all during their time. But I've always been kind of fascinated with New York in the 60s and the Warhol 60s. So I would want to be in the Velvet Underground. And again, I'm focusing on the
You have the talent to be in the Velvet Underground right now.
So I'm focusing on the part of your question that is experience their fame. Because I don't, you know, I would love to be a part of that world in that scene during that time.
That would be crazy.
Right. That it's not about the Velvet Underground. I like the Velvet Underground quite a bit. Clearly more than Jason does. But I mean, that's not my favorite band in the world. But to experience that time and be a big player in that time, in that space, in that scene, that's who I chose.
It's weird that we both chose like these small little pockets of
in the 1960s
culture, and they were different. I mean, they were completely different, but that's strange that we both pick bands that we don't really listen to all that often. That's weird. That's interesting. I like your answer. I can see that though, because there was a lot of crazy shit going on then.
Yeah, it was great. It was kind of,
I think it was bad for the art world, but I think, I think what the art was happening then was really good, but I think it spawned a lot of bad art.
But it was also kind of a, I don't want to say creation, but it was certainly development of a new kind of underground in some ways. Such thing as underground anymore. Certainly not in the United States.
I thought that's an interesting answer.
Our final email is from Drew, and it's not a question. It's simply a point about how life is tough trying to become a point niner. His wife of 5 years told him, quote, "Shut that off. Your podcast is not allowed in the bedroom." I think your wife has good advice for you, Drew. And
don't listen to this in the bedroom.
If you are a podcast listener, do not listen to this in the bedroom. It's really, you know, put on some Barry White or something, Drew.
I mean, it might, shit, for all you know, it might piss John off. Now, he might not be okay with you listening to this in the bedroom setting.
It might be sexy.
It might be too sexy.
So that's it for the email. Before we were not going to go yet, Jason, you do have an impromptu that just happened that almost combines with an unplanned what are you drinking. So go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So I had to go run out to the deli. And at my door, on the outside of the door, obviously, was a six-pack of beer with a note from one of the neighbors saying, you know, enjoy, you know, from the tenants and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, hey, you know, that's pretty cool. You know, I don't – obviously, maybe they just moved in because there's been some people moving in or out. I don't remember. And, you know, you've lived in the big city before, Country Mouse.
I sure have, so, believe it or not, people.
You know what it's like to live in a building. Sometimes I lived in a building for 6 years and I didn't ever meet anybody on the third floor.
Right.
So it's not always a community. You know, I don't always know these people, but I thought this was a nice gesture. You know, I thought this was really, really cool. That is certainly a way to, certainly an approach I appreciate, you know, leaving a six pack of beer, a Saranac. Big Moose Ale? Is it Saranac or Saranac?
Like I would know.
Okay, well, I don't know. I've never had it before. I've had this beer before, but I've never had the Big Moose Ale before, and it's actually really good, and it was cold, okay? Which I also appreciate. It's like someone had been listening to the podcast, and they know, hey, if we leave this guy beer, he better have a chill. You know? And so I went on my way down, I knock on the door, you know, to say, hey, welcome to the building. I appreciate the beer. You know, if you ever need anything, just let me know. As it turns out, it was somebody who moved out and had a falling out with the neighbor, with their roommate, and took their beer out of the refrigerator and left it on my door, and took the time to write the note. And the girl who answered the door was like, "Oh, that guy moved out. He's a complete jerk. Please keep the beer. Sorry about it. Here's the thing. Sorry about that." It's like, oh yeah, that I'm pissed off about that. I mean, come on. And I was like, oh well, the fact remains that if you ever need anything, you know, welcome to the building. And they're like, oh yeah, we've been living here for like a year. He just moved out. Fucking awesome. You know, I wanted to tell Juan about it, but he was busy.
How's Juan doing?
Well, he's, let me see. The cops are gone, so I guess he's doing
Okay,
better.
or he's in a cop car.
Oh, probably not. I don't think they can get anything to stick.
Let's talk about what's going on the week ahead, like we always end the show with. And of course, the week ahead's a big one. We're going to Dallas. And Dallas is where the winter meetings are. Jason and I are both flying in on Sunday. If you are a person with SiriusXM Radio and the MLB Network Radio, we'll be doing a show. I will be doing a show live on Sunday night with Mike Farren and Steve Goldman from the site, from the hotel, from I think 7 to 11 or something like that.
Damn, that's what.
And then I'll be doing some appearances with them here and there. I'll be doing some stuff also for Comcast Sports Chicago here and there. If you live in Chicago and you have a television. But for those 3 days, of course, you know, we'll be running around doing winter meeting stuff, which consists of meeting with people that you know that you spend, you know, 362 days a year simply talking to on the phone or chatting with each other on IM or emailing. You actually get to spend time in person with them and say hello and thank you and let me buy you a drink and do you need anything from me and can I do anything for you and blah, blah, blah. And at the same time, I will be running around. There'll be a much more of a commitment to the show than there was last year. I'm going to be running around getting interviews with people when I can, and you know, mostly with people who we already know. You know, I'm sure we'll have an interview with Jonah, Corey Schwartz. And find also, you know, a lot of the writers that we've had on. I'm sure Zach Levine, Derek Gould, Dylan Hernandez, all those kind of guys. We'll pull them aside maybe for 5 minutes. And if we can find someone from baseball, we can pull aside from 5 minutes or an agent or another member of the media. So the show will be kind of a series of short interviews, and then Jason and I'll probably do a wrap up every night. So the plan is to have a show up hopefully Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday night. So that'd be three. And then Thursday was the Rule 5 and getting on a plane. So that'll be
Yes.
it. So those are the, that'll be it for the shows that week. We're not going to do a full show. And then next week we'll come back and wrap everything up. So we will be in Dallas working. I'll be working on the show. Jason will both be writing some stuff. We both have some non-writing things, if you will, to take care of while we're there. It's going to be a busy, hectic time. But nonetheless, one that I look forward to every year.
Sure, it'll be a lot of fun.
It's
Looking forward to
I
seeing
can't wait.
friends and
You know, it's important. And so it's always like this week's always like a fun week because you keep getting emails that simply say things like Dallas. And then you open it like,
Right.
hey, are you going to be in Dallas? What are you doing? We should get together. And so I have many people who I'm having beers or a meal or something with. And I heard from a big league executive right before we started the show that's like, hey, what are you doing? I have very little up on my docket. And so, you know, basically he's like, he's telling me, entertain me. I have nothing else to do. And so, you know, we'll be doing, you know, a lot of work and a lot of schmoozing. And of course, if you, again, if you don't follow us on Twitter, that would be the time because I'm sure we'll be tweeting like crazy.
Yeah, we will.
And so,
Everybody will. I mean, it'll be crazy. I hope we get sick, get a signal.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get a signal too. I'll probably be walking around. Obviously, we'll have our phones and our iPads and our whatnots.
You gonna wear the fedora in the lobby?
Am I, do you want me to?
I think you should.
I mean, I'll certainly be bringing one or two of them.
Two, bringing two of them. In case one doesn't work out.
And so, I mean, the BP crew will consist of myself and Jason and Stephen Goldman will be there, and I believe Jay Jaffe will be there.
Yeah, the television celebrity, Jay Jaffe.
This JJ was on Clubhouse Confidential on MLB Network.
Did you watch it?
I did. He was great.
Yeah, he was great.
He was fantastic. It was good, and a great opportunity for him as well.
I thought his mustache looked even thicker.
It looked good. It did look good in high def. It was, you know what it was, Jason?
It was the mustache.
It was sexy.
It was sexy.
So there you go, John. But so that's it. So you will probably get the next show, which will be 75.1, I guess we'll call it, on Monday night. So, you know, Monday will be running around getting interviews when I can. Then Jason and I will wrap up the night and we'll put it all together and upload it. As long as we don't have Mexican internet. It's quite often in these hotels we only have Mexican internet. We'll do our best to work around it when we can.
Yes.
So, Jason, it's time for the saddest part of the show.
It is.
A short show. But you know what? Now I look at the clock, it wasn't that short.
But yeah, well, maybe I should check outside and see if there's more beer waiting for me.
And so
it was awesome development.
And so it's time to say goodbye to the internet.
Goodbye, internet.
And we'll talk to you next week from Dallas. Thanks for listening, everyone.
What is it you see? Do you tire of your isolation? You reached into a tent to touch a mountaineer's soft cheek, and yet you cower whenever we approach, like a blur, like a wintry ghost, like a blur.